So Dave, thanks for the initial interview. That was great. So I'm really looking forward to talk some more here on this extension. It's when Matthias and I started this podcast, I was really thinking about you right away. Been appreciating all your insights on gaming all along the way, and yeah, so it was you. I was thinking we were going back to, I think it was 2017 or 18. We connected, and when you talked about Nintendo here, I was kind of chuckling because I've been following your hardship with the Nintendo management, not really doing anything, and or at least what you want them to do with their IPs. And all your sorrow tweets about it, yeah, and then we were planning to make a short interview with you, and we talked offline, and I was just like, wow, this guy knows so much more than I ever realized. So I really wanted to have this opportunity to have you tell some more about what you know about the gaming industry. So welcome again.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I would like to hear your thoughts on the console cycle coming up, sort of from a top-down view or zoom out, and maybe start by resuming what happened in the last console cycle, and give your thoughts on how this one will differ from the last one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to kind of address the console cycle that's kind of ending right now, I think we have to go back just a little bit further. So we need to go back to the previous generation. I think probably would help people kind of understand how we're getting to this next generation. And so if you recall, the last generation would have been PS3 versus Xbox 360. And what had happened was, at that point in time, Sony's coming off a very successful PS2. And obviously, I think they got a little bit overly confident with what they were trying to accomplish there. And they came out with a PS3 that, if I recall, I think it was $600. Xbox 360 at the time launched at a very consumer-friendly price. I think it was like $399. And the two of them couldn't have been more different. The PS3 initially was kind of focused on this super fancy hardware, all the bells and whistles that they thought that the consumer wanted, but they virtually made the mistake of not really implementing any of the new games into those presentations, where Xbox was totally the opposite. There is this all their games that they would be putting on this console. It was going to have things that people were trying at that time were just starting to get into, like in-game chat and being able to be online. And they really, for a while, Xbox was really just taking market share away from Sony. But by the end of that generation, things had kind of evened up a little bit. Microsoft had a very very public issue with their quality of their Xbox 360, which a lot of people had quality issues there, and they ended up having to extend warranties and things like that. And then while all that was going on, Sony finally got their act together. They were able to lower their price of the PS3, and they really started focusing on some of their exclusive games towards the end of that generation. So that kind of segued into the current generation that's ending right now. And one thing that I should also add that was part of the previous generation is you had this wildly successful Wii. And as we all know, Nintendo, even they kind of do things on their own and they kind of drop these things. But their technology initially is usually somewhat groundbreaking. And one of the things that they brought with the Wii was, I guess, what you would call like motion control with your controllers. So if you guys had a Wii, or you remember, this is, you know, you could play tennis with your controller. The Wii Fit was big, right? I mean, the Wii Sports package is, I think, still one of the best all-time selling games because they bundled it with the actual Wii. So that became kind of innovative. And of course, towards the end of that generation, Sony and Microsoft were both trying to implement that type of control with the generation that came out right now. So as we moved into the generation we are right now, PS4, PlayStation, they kind of continued to learn from the issues that they had with the PS3, and they were going to launch this game, the PS4, with exclusive games. They had been buying up some of these properties, as well as they already have a lot of support in Japan from the Eastern Japanese gamers, so that wasn't going to be a problem. And then for some reason, Xbox decided to kind of get a little bit overconfident of what they were doing. And it's almost like the roles got reversed. The Xbox launched their console at like $500, while the PS4 launched at like $100, less than that. And the thing about Xbox is that everyone will remember about this generation and where they lost it, I think is when they had the little bit of the controversy where you couldn't use games, you couldn't use, like, your friends couldn't come over and play their games in their system because they had some sort of a locking code mechanism on it, which they quickly had to reverse because PlayStation totally made fun of that. And even in a presentation, I kind of remember the management there sharing a game on stage with their friend just to kind of make fun of how obtuse that rule kind of made. And I think that kind of doomed Microsoft from the beginning, along with they were focused on kind of like the bells and whistles again of their system, how you could connect to a TV, how you had to have like this online connection at all times, things that they would have to eventually correct. But as soon as that presentation went by, you know, suddenly you see nobody was going to buy an Xbox and everyone was going to buy a PS4. And the good news for both of those companies is Nintendo, when they came out with their post-Wii, they called it the Wii U. And even for myself, they didn't make any type of distinction of how that was different from the Wii, and that totally bombed. So they were totally out of it. So Sony actually had really, I would say, that console generation almost all to themselves until, you know, just until the last few years when the Nintendo Switch came out. So as we kind of end this console race here, I think PlayStation has sold like 110 million units or more. Microsoft hasn't really given out their data on how many consoles that they've sold in quite a number of years, but it sounds like a lot of people are estimating that it's about half that, around in the 50 million. And here we are with a Nintendo Switch. I'm surely they're going to show, they're at like 61 million right now, and they've had probably one of the best summers they've had in a number of years. So when they do report here in November, it's probably going to be quite a big tick up from there. And that kind of segues us into this next generation, which is, again, pitting PlayStation versus Xbox. But I think this generation is going to look a little bit different than what we've seen. And if I had to give a little bit of an edge right now, I think I would give an edge to the PlayStation 5, only because it won this generation pretty handily. And when you start talking about backwards compatibility and things like that, there's more people that have PlayStations right now. And if they want to port those libraries up to the next generation, you know, right now is there's going to be more people that are going to want to port PlayStation games to the PlayStation 5. So I would give them an edge on that, as well as their exclusives are still really pretty solid, with Spider-Man and is going to be one of the big ones. And that's kind of how people kind of forget, I think, that when you really kind of start taking a look at consoles, it's not the consoles that sell the games, it's the software that sells the consoles. So whoever has the best intellectual property or the best exclusive game titles from some of these publishers is typically going to be the console that's going to win. And I would have to give that edge right now to PS5, just because they've owned the PS4, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally does. Yeah.
The thing is, how this is going to go down is a little bit different now, though, because Xbox have kind of proved in their even in how they report sales, that they're not really concerned, I don't think, with how many consoles that they sell. And let's face it, with the Game Pass now, if you have a pretty decent gaming computer PC, you don't really need to buy the console. You can just buy the Game Pass and you'll be able to get kind of like that Netflix of gaming on your PC. Or if you want to be on the go, they got their Project X Cloud. You'll be able to play your games on your phone. Android right now, and I think eventually that's going to launch on the iPhone as well. So that's totally kind of a different approach than what Sony is going to be taking. And along with that Game Pass, Xbox has said that their exclusive titles, which, you know, Forza, Halo, State of Decay, those will all be available as long as you subscribe to their Game Pass on day one. And that's something that Sony has not committed to. So that's going to probably be pretty enticing for a certain crowd out there. But one thing I will say is for Microsoft is they have not been able to kind of penetrate some of these global areas that PlayStation has been in. So there could be a little bit of an appealing to some of those consumers that can't quite actually afford a console, but still want to enjoy some of the Xbox games.
Yeah, wow. I'm thinking and thinking about it. So it seems like I'm thinking about the thing that Sony is being hosted by Microsoft on the cloud. What do you think? Does that have any implications for what is going to happen?
You know, I don't think that it does. Other than the fact that if we're starting to migrate towards this cloud type of gaming future, I do think eventually that could be very advantageous for the Xbox series. And I think that's I think that's kind of what they've been continuing to push. And it really, if they're successful, Xbox is successful, I think it just really is going to come down to what kind of content can they put out, and is that going to be something that their audience wants? Is it going to be something that brings people into their ecosystem? I think PlayStation right now, at least over the last few years, they've definitely have set themselves apart with the type of exclusives that you've been able to play on their system. I mean, if you want Naughty Dog, you're going to play it on or whatever Naughty Dog brings out next. I mean, that's going to be on PlayStation. The Marvel Spider-Man game, that's going to be on PlayStation. So they've done a very good job at wrapping in a lot of exclusives with PlayStation. I think that matters more than kind of all these kind of what I say, you know, where the people get into the drama, whether it's teraflops or how does it look, how the games look, all these little other isolated things. For me, I just try to simplify it and just kind of see, hey, what is the content coming out on these machines? Because that's ultimately what's going to make or break the success of either one of them.
What also strikes me from what you're saying is that Microsoft might have a better product for what used to be Sony's market, sort of the because it would be cheaper to get access to, because you might not need the console. So what do you see? What will you be paying attention to over the next year or two to kind of get a feeling of who's being the better horse here, Sony or Microsoft?
Yeah, I think the early signs will probably be is how many new people are being added into the Microsoft ecosystem. And that is a figure that I think they do generally start giving out, if not quarterly, they do try to give out the number of subscribers they have for their Game Pass. If not quarterly, they do at least a couple of times a year, let us know. I think both systems right now in their ecosystems, I think they're both boasting, you know, they have like 100 million monthly active users or something like that. I think that's where you're gonna start seeing the success show up, is how well people are subscribing to basically Xbox's so-called Netflix of gaming. And yeah, I think that's gonna be the best barometer. And then really you'll have to start seeing how excited people are getting about their games. You know, obviously Bethesda was a huge purchase by them. I mean, you know, a lot of people make a big deal about the price tag, which was $7.5 billion. But when you're talking about a company like Microsoft, it's not really that much money for them when you have $30 billion in cash holdings, and you know, in any quarter on that cash holdings, they're making $5-6 billion just on their treasury investments. So, that's really what I wish it was as complex as some of these guys make it out to be, but I think it's just for an investor, I think it just, if you can try to just simplify it to like, it's really going to come down to the best games and who has the best exclusives and where does that crowd kind of lean towards. And I will say, you know, if you're on the Microsoft side, it does seem to me like that, they're building a little bit momentum here that, the Xbox Series S is going to be $299 or something like that. So it's a very affordable way to get an upgrade. It's not going to have like the 4K right at least right at the beginning, but you know, it's definitely, they're definitely making an attempt to bring more people into their ecosystem.
Yeah, and that's where the money is going to be earned later on. So buying Bethesda and selling the consoles for cheap or the services for cheap, that will be like customer acquisition costs, and then the money will be earned along the way when you have a lot of people on your platform that you can sell games or services or whatever for. I'm just curious, are you invested in either Sony or Microsoft, and can you say two words about why you are or aren't?
So I've been a longer term shareholder of Microsoft, not just for the gaming, but for the cloud, for the software. I've kind of sat through long periods of Microsoft where the stock hasn't done anything. If you've seen me or know me for a while, I often make jokes about having to survive the Steve Ballmer era of Microsoft. And that was very painful, almost as painful. I always allude to that as it's been as painful as holding Nintendo for as long as I have.
Here we go again.
Two super painful places to be with management that seems to always meet your worst expectations. But Satya Nadella has done an awesome job with Microsoft, and I think I'm not the one that thought of this. That's been told so many times. I think when you have an engineer like Satya running a computer company, I think he gets it, and the sky's the limit for Microsoft right now. They can continue to bring on with the work from home and into the cloud. I think to get gaming and all that, I think it's a pretty solid stock and to be in, no matter where the market goes. If you have the patience and until something better comes along, which right now there's not much competition for them, especially in the cloud. I think being long Microsoft makes a lot of sense as one of your stable investments. Sony is a little bit different story. Sony, I don't hold a position right now. I do kind of trade around that position. I think one of the tougher things, as I've learned by being a Nintendo investor, is that there's a lot of moving parts when you're investing in not just the Japanese company, but foreign companies in and of itself. You have to understand the currency. You have to understand the management styles from a different country. If you invest locally, there's certain tax implications. So, I would advise, when you kind of look at something outside your surroundings, you need to kind of pay attention to some of these things. And then just information. Sometimes information isn't always as quick as they are from like an American company. So I have been kind of paring back on some of my foreign holdings, mainly because it's really hard to keep track of them all. But I know Sony is a top pick by Eital Goya over at the Jefferies. He's been one of the brighter analysts that I follow, one of the few analysts that I follow in the gaming sector. I know it's his top pick. I know he thinks it's going to do extremely well. But with Microsoft, with Sony, it's not a gaming pure play. So you're gonna have some risk there with the sensors and everything else that goes in with Sony. So it's a little bit sometimes difficult to ascertain, like, what am I really getting when I buy that, and how much upside do I get just from the console?
Yeah, I also feel it takes discipline to hold Japanese stocks, because oftentimes you don't hear anything, you don't know anything, and the information level is so little. So for me at least, if I suddenly feel like another stock is a good buy, it's really, I don't know, my brain just doesn't work that way. So I can keep sort of a stock that are not really telling me anything. So
yeah.
I'm on the same page there.
Yep.
So I was thinking about the other platforms in the new console cycle. There's Nintendo with the Switch mm-hmm. platform, Google Stadia, and maybe other mm-hmm. cloud players, and Facebook is working hard to get a meaningful VR platform out. So how do you see those fitting into the picture of the new consoles?
Yeah, and that's a very good question, because unlike this console generation that's kind of ending right now, the PS4 versus the Xbox, you know, for the bulk of the time, you know, PlayStation really didn't have much competition. I mean, it was early to see that Xbox had kind of failed, and until just the last few years when Nintendo Switch came on, they've had a pretty clean run at it. And that's not going to be the same, at least in the first year here of the console, because the Switch continues to sell very strongly. I mean, at their last quarter update, I think the Switch console was up like 200% year over year. And with the NPD data that was out today, it sounds like, you know, they just had another banner month. I can see from my channel checks here in suburban Seattle that whatever inventory is coming in, it's going right out the door in sales. So, you know, Nintendo is about as good as it gets, I think, for Nintendo. And, you know, I think that they're slowly making some changes and trying to get into some of these areas that people have wanted them to for so long, whether that be forming some a cloud relationship themselves, whether that's with Google or Microsoft or Amazon, as well as just having normal in-game chat while you're playing. That's one thing that people continue to kind of get upset about with Animal Crossing. You know, but they're going to have a terrific year. And the funny thing is with Nintendo is, as they have for the last few years, is they really didn't put forth a very credible earnings estimates. Last year was a really good year. So for fiscal year 21, they guided down like 8%. They guided ordinary profit down like 20%. Their hardware estimates this year is still down 10% from last year. Their software estimate was down like 20%. So when they initially gave out this guidance back in March, you know, you're just kind of like, what are they doing? It's just, you get really upset, right?
It's just, I remember it's, you.
It's so not credible. It's just like, gosh, how am I in this stock? Right. So it gets really, really frustrating. And, you know, the Q1 sales come out with the COVID tailwind. I mean, sales were up 108% year over year. Ordinary profit was up nearly 600% year over year. And they did not raise guidance. So everyone knows that guidance is going to go up here at the mid-year, but I have no idea, like, where their thought process is there. And it hasn't been very credible for, you know, a few years now, ever since the previous CEO totally overshot how many Switches. This would have been year two Switches that they were going to sell. And from there, it just seems to be progressively getting worse on how they put their estimates. So it makes it almost impossible for any institutional investor to trust these numbers and to belong in this name. But I also feel
it also keeps private investors totally in the dark, because yeah. Professional or skillful investors have more sort of ability to see through the numbers. So mm-hmm. I actually remember it threw me off Nintendo because I had no chance of knowing what was going on. I'm curious about the cloud and VR. Where do you see those in this console cycle and
the cloud? You know, I'm a little bit, you know, I should probably just say, for the most part, you've got a lot of drama, as we see, like on Twitter and among some of our gaming friends. Some really good analysts out there. And for me as an investor, I just see like all this drama, and I'm always just trying to figure out like what is like the simplest way of explaining this to somebody, or the simplest way of kind of identifying what makes sense as an investor, right? And you know, everyone has these really super strong opinions. And when you talk about, I'm assuming when you talk about the cloud, we're kind of talking about like how Xbox, you know, they're going to try to start pushing people into, you know, maybe console agnostic, right? And that's exactly what Stadia is doing. You know, the unfortunate part of this at the cloud at this junction right now is that when you look, at least at the US, is not everybody has access to broadband that is probably optimal for cloud only gaming, if that makes sense. You know, I actually had a chance to take a look at the Stadia. I played Mortal Kombat on there for a few minutes. And, you know, I'm not a hardcore gamer, but as a casual gamer, you know, right away I could see the utility of that type of a device. And I think that certainly as technologies get better, as broadband hopefully gets a little bit cheaper and faster here in the US, I absolutely think that is an avenue that is going to transpire at some point. I do not think that that's going to be anytime soon, but it is something that's going to continue to improve. And I think, you know, down the line, that's going to be something that a lot of players are going to have to manage around. VR, I think, is kind of in that same time frame. I have not been able to use. I have not tested out the new VRs here that Facebook is putting out. But my initial reaction back when VR started coming out a few years back was that the technology was a little bit early. And then I just take something that's just really simple, which a lot of people just kind of laugh at me when I say this, but you know, 61% of Americans have corrective lenses. So by putting something on your face, it just is a little bit awkward for a lot of people, especially for someone like me that wears glasses. So if I have to put something on my face, where do I put my glasses? You know, and gosh, I'm already wearing glasses all day. Do I really want to sit there with something on my face just during my downtime? And, you know, maybe that makes me sound like an old man, but it just doesn't seem like that technology is quite yet ready to go mainstream. And so I think that that's going to be a very niche part of the market. But, you know, I think you have to very much keep an eye on where they take that, because I do believe that somewhere down the line, when maybe those headsets get a little bit lighter and the technology and the broadband is all there in one place, that it's probably going to be a really cool part of everyday life.
And makes sense.
And as you kind of see, I think the segue into VR is probably AR. I think AR is definitely going to get there a lot faster. If you see like even some of the presentations and even now with work at home, you can see AR kind of starting to immerse, being a little bit more immersive in everyday lives, whether you even realize it's there or not.
Can you give some examples? Where do you see it in everyday lives?
I think, you know, for simple things like, and it's becoming just more immersive in gaming. It started off with Pokemon Go, which was a really clever mobile title. There's definitely more mobile titles out there, but you know, I do believe that at some point, as you have like the Alexas and Google Voice and Apple Siri, that it's going to be quite possible for them to kind of start managing some of your mundane daily routine tasks. And whether that's just to remind you that, you know, put your alarm on before you leave your house, or, you know, turn on your coffee machine in the morning. I think little things like that, where with the right type of lenses, I think you could have like reminders, or you could have like your alarm clock ring, you know, kind of virtually like that. I think that type of crazy world is coming a little bit faster than I think people realize.
Yeah, we'll get a little bit further into that. But first, I'd like to hear your thoughts on or your thesis on GameStop. I've been seeing your tweets about GameStop, and I've just been one of those guys saying, "Oh, all physical is going to die." So I'm not paying attention to this. And then offline, you told me your thesis, and I think it was so enlightening. So could you yeah, please tell us about GameStop. What do you see in it?
Yeah, GameStop is just another one of those names. You know, sometimes I get myself in trouble with names like this, and sometimes I get lucky. But you know, I will say there was the longest time where I was just like, gosh, GameStop is dead. I mean, I was definitely in that camp where, you know, things were not going well. And it's a little bit unfortunate, because if you know the story of GameStop in its heyday, it was doing really a terrific job in customer service. The big revenue generator is just the resale of games. And, you know, unfortunately, they brought in a management team that could see that this digital future was on the horizon. And unfortunately, that management team decided to leverage up and go after the cell phone business and try to become a cell phone dealer for the most part. And that was obviously an utter failure. And then getting rid of that and then paying off that debt has really, what I think has really hastened the decline of the company. And I don't think a lot of people really realize that that's kind of how GameStop really kind of started rolling over, was that just really bad foresight into how to create additional revenue outside their gaming platform. So, you know, so the stock totally craters, but, you know, like I said, it's one of those names where you kind of like look, finally it gets to a point where you're looking at it and you realize like they're still generating a lot of cash. And even right now, I think they have like $6 a share in cash, $6 or $7 a share in cash for, I think, a $13 stock or so. And so everyone that is banking on an imminent bankrupt, they're going to be wrong. And they may be right 7 or 8 years from now, but right now, they're not. It's not going to go bankrupt anytime soon. So when the stock was $3 or $4 and you realize that, you know, from a financial engineering standpoint, they could technically just buy themselves out and take themselves private with the cash that they have. You know, you start realizing, well, I mean, in a liquidation, how much would I get? And I was always like, well, the stock's at 350, the stock's at four, you know, maybe you get like $7 or $8 in a liquidation. So it just became kind of like the play that I like is like, you know, the stock is trading below cash value. And then, you know, I started a few years back. My daughter is a 12-year-old and she loves gaming and she wanted to start going to some of these gaming shows. And, you know, so we started going to these gaming shows. And then over the last few years, you start seeing like really just these crowds just becoming more and more and more enormous. And they're passionate, you know, their customers can feel that passion. And you start realizing like there is going to be a need at least, you know, for at least a few more years of that third place, so to speak, for gamers. And I think
so. You'll keep your game shop stocks so far.
Yes, I'm still on GameStop. You know, it's had quite the ride here, and they're doing everything right now that they needed to do. And the announcement that they made a couple weeks ago with Microsoft and kind of, you know, taking their supply chain and their inventory and be able to be more customer centric and the revenue share that they're going to get by selling the Xbox All Access. I think that's definitely whether it turns out to be as big of an earnings gain as, you know, the stock is certainly showing right now. I don't know, because neither company has really said like exactly, you know, what is that revenue look like. But people have said that they've talked to management and said there's going to be some downstream revenue for them. So they're going to get a piece of being that middleman to get people onto the Xbox system and then further transactions that they make down the line. So I think the big signal there though is that they understand that the future is going towards digital and they're going to start closing deals with some of these companies to find new revenue. But the biggest thing I see about GameStop is I think like there is a place for GameStop and there's a place where people want to meet. And as soon as they close the Microsoft stores, and maybe suburban Seattle is a little bit unique. I mean, Microsoft is in our backyard. Nintendo's in our backyard. We have a strong gaming culture here, but you could see at the Microsoft store when they held these esports events, I mean, the kids would just jam pack the Microsoft store. So I think there is a model here for GameStop if they want to survive. And the first thing that you start seeing is, well, they have 60 million PowerUp Reward members that pay $20 a year. You know, how do you add value to that service where maybe you could eventually raise that price and how do you convince publishers to continue to be part of your store? Well, I think that starts with this whole thing that's going on. It's, you know, it's multi-channel, it's esports, it's socializing, and if you could make like GameStop look like a mini gaming conference, I think that they could do quite well. Now, do they need 5,000 stores? They probably don't need 5,000 stores. But I think that they've making a couple of steps in the right direction. And one is they did add Reggie Phil Zamee, who is the former CEO of Nintendo North America, to the board. Ryan Cohen, who is the founder of Chewy, the pet store, online pet store, has become an activist shareholder. I think if they could improve the online experience, somehow add more value to their PowerUp subscription, whether that's through exclusives, discounts, free shipping. They do some of that right now, but if it was more, if you're thinking in a digital gaming world, if they were to add like whatever free different clothing or skins or in-game content to some of the exclusive games, you know, they need to sell that whole experience. And I don't think that that's what they've done very well. And I think that if they were to try to sell that whole experience, I think they could do quite well.
Yeah, it's always with something having been sort of placed in the world to do one thing and then has to transform to do another thing. It's always whether it's going to be better than building it from scratch. Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of the common thing with a lot of this digital going physical, that some of the existing physical are not really fit for that sort of one channel future. But I think listening to this would be sort of the key question. But it makes a ton of sense, the case that games needs physical presence for customers to experience and to touch.
I think the publishers will want socialize. It too. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the publishers will want it too. They still, I think, need a retail presence to be able to show off what they're trying to reach, right? Yeah. And I just think that there's a place for GameStop. And I know the majority of people, as you can see, you know, whatever, 90-100% of the shares are all short the stock. So there's a lot of people that are rooting against me, but I don't think that a lot of those people have been to these gaming shows and have been able to kind of witness this growth that's going on. And if the public, I just have a hard time believing that the publishers are just going to say, okay, our big marketing is just going to be at these four or five gaming shows every year. And then the rest of the year, we're going to be online and email marketing or, you know, some of the non-physical way of reaching their customers. I just don't think that that's how it's going to be anytime soon.
Yeah, it makes totally sense. So we're getting a little bit long here, it's so fantastic. I really want to hear your thoughts on the metaverse, just a short take on that to pick your brain, and then I want to ask you about Unity if you're along. But if I say metaverse, games, and investment, what are your thoughts?
Metaverse, I just think that it's a little bit early. I think it's just something that I'm kind of watching right now. I'm trying to kind of understand it all. I mean, as you know, Mads, as somebody in our fourth and fifth decade of life, when you really immerse yourself into the metaverse and you think about it, I mean, it's really hard for the brain to comprehend at times and what's about ready to transpire in our world. And I think that there's some exciting things about it. I think there's some, you know, kind of scary things about it. When I look at my kids, I know that this is something that is going to be probably part of their lives. And for me, I'm a little bit sad because I think I'm really just gonna miss like the really cool stuff before it happens, dude. Yeah. Unfortunately. So I'm always a little bit sad about that, but it, you know, Fortnite has done a great job as far as gaming as part of that metaverse and bringing in concerts. And I think this COVID right now has definitely accelerated people meeting or taking, you know, their own images and dressing them how they like and being in an electronic world. And I think, you know, by everyone that's talking about it, whether it's Matthew Ball or, you know, some of the companies like Adobe and even Unity and Unreal over at Epic Games, it's only going to continue to expand where, you know, there's going to be a point that I think that you're not, you know, like the digital and the physical world are going to merge. And that's, I think, really hard for a lot of people to kind of really grasp right now. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. But also, like also that there are not really sort of any investments that sort of comes to your mind that you say you need to have.
I do think that there's some early investments, and I think that they're all cloud gaming, or excuse me, just cloud investments right now, right? So to get where the metaverse is probably going to go, where we're talking like where this probably, so right now, the way that I understand it is like, if you want to get on the internet, you are actually physically going to the internet, right? To search or to do whatever business that you're going to take. Even if you're doing that whether it's on your phone or whether it's on a laptop, you physically have to go to something, right?
Yeah.
So when the metaverse starts, you're not going to have to physically go to the internet. It's almost like the internet is going to come to you, right? So if you're thinking of what that person is wearing next to you, there's going to be something that pops up and tells you where to buy it from. And that's the kind of stuff that gets a little bit crazy for me. And so that infrastructure is not quite there yet. But there's developers right now that are probably out there that are preparing for it. And it's going to be a lot of these, I think, cloud companies, Microsoft for sure, Amazon for sure, Google for sure, to name just, you know, for your listeners to name some big companies that are definitely going to be involved. If you look at like platformers, like I think you mentioned Unity, I think Unity, absolutely, that's kind of what they're thinking. To kind of grow their customer base outside of gaming, they want to get into, you know, like the segue into like this metaverse, where either having construction companies or real estate companies or online education, kind of having this AR type transactional and presence. So it's really exciting stuff. I think it's really hard for the brain to wrap around at times. But I think it's definitely the future. And like even like Adobe, who's they're definitely going to be there designing some of these platforms, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm curious, are you long Unity?
I'm not long Unity right now, but I am keeping a super close eye on it. And my main issue with Unity is just the valuation right now. I think right now you're probably paying a little bit forward on the growth. Obviously, it's really hard to predict how far in this type of a market you know that can go. I might end up being wrong, but if you kind of take a look at, I think their market cap is like $25 billion right now. They're not making any money. I think their revenue is, I think, like $500 million or something like that. But if you kind of like compare that to like a gaming company, Take-Two is going to do $3 billion in revenue this year, and their market cap is only $18 billion. So it's kind of hard for me to pay up for growth right now. But you know, that doesn't mean I'm going to be right.
No.
It's just really hard. To get to where Unity wants to go, I think it's going to take at least a couple more years. And I think right now, if you were to buy the stock right now, you're probably paying for growth for a couple more years ahead of us right now. And that's kind of my thoughts.
Perfect. Yeah, we'll wrap it up here. It's been okay. Really cool to have you. I think one of the things that sort of really dawned to me was that even though gaming seems like a no-brainer growth mm-hmm. sector, you really have to sort of look around and be a little bit cautious. Also, if you invest in gaming, you can't invest in some of the high growth areas like cloud or e-commerce or something. So,
yeah. I think if there was anything I probably should have just kind of mentioned is that, you know, the gaming is such a big universe right now. And I think there's a little bit something for everyone. There's, we didn't really have a chance to hit on mobile, but there's the mobile side of things. There's the console side of things. There's the hybrids. And for me, if you're looking for growth names, I think you have to be a little bit choosy on what you pick right now.
So just two quick growth names that you look for or that you have in gaming?
Yeah, I mean, right now, a name that we both know very well, SE. I mean, when they're putting up 100% year-over-year quarters, it's hard to be in a name that's only doing 8% on the year, right? So yeah. SE is one of those stories, but I would probably call that like the hybrid that I'm more attracted to right now. It's got payments, it's got shopping, it's got the streaming, it's global. I think that's more the type of stock that I'm attracted to. I like Tencent. I mean, there's tons of headline risk and it's really hard to get information there, but you know, it's the same models. It's got the streaming. It's got all these little pieces out there in the world of different gamers. It's got the payments. So those are the more things that I think I feel a little bit safer with than just something in a single silo where you're hoping that the next game that they release is going to be a hit. And that's kind of.
So Dave, you're holding both C Limited and Tencent?
Yeah, Tencent, I've been a long-term holder. It's been kind of painful at times, but I've been a long-term holder of Tencent. I don't plan to sell it. SE is, that's something that Mods got me on and I've been extremely grateful for that. And I probably need to send him a bottle of wine for.
I'll hold you up on that.
And then like Gravity things, I really my type of gaming name is something that I think is a little bit displaced, a little bit that's people aren't really paying attention to, and I can really kind of dig into the story and extract the value. And I think right now, like with the new consoles launching, I think a lot of people gravitate towards Activision and Electronic Arts and Take-Two. And those are fine names, I think. But if you're looking for a growth story, if you're scared that you're going to get left behind because, you know, in other sectors like the cloud names are just taking off, I think you're going to be a little bit disappointed.
Okay. Awesome, Dave. Super, super exciting to hear your take on all these things. Massive thanks for participating.
I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
I'm humbled. I hope it works out great for you guys. I love what you're doing.
It's been fantastic. And you can find Dave at Twitter mm-hmm. at what's your handle?
Alpha Verve.
Yeah. Looking him up and support him when Nintendo management is downplaying their future earnings. Thanks for now, Dave.
Yep. It's been great. Thank you. We'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank you. Yep. You too. Thank Bye. You.
Bye.
Bye.